This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
I'm Ross Kemp, and this is the Kemp Cast. In this podcast, I'm joined by guests from all walks of life who all have engaging stories to tell, whether it's about their life, their career, or their expertise. I hope that if you listen to this series, not only will you learn something about the guests, but also about the world we live in. Joining me today is Luis Navia. He spent 25 years working as a drug trafficker for some of the world's most powerful drug lords, including Pablo Escobar, leader of the infamous Medellin cartel.
Luis, thank you so much for agreeing to talk to me. Fascinating story. Pio Narco is quite an amazing book. It's rare that you get someone who has been involved in the narcotics trade, the illegal narcotics trade, to talk so openly about their lives and their lifestyles. And also, you know, I do get that you are 100% genuine. And there are so many things that gives me that belief when you read the book. I mean, you come from a pretty privileged background in Cuba. I take it once a revolution happened, you left.
Yes. It has to do a lot with who you are, your personality. I mean, I went to very good schools, and there were people that I went to school with that they wanted to be a doctor. They wanted to be an engineer or an architect. All I knew was that I wanted to be involved in business and make money. But my thing was, I wasn't going to be a lawyer or an architect or anything like that. I was an entrepreneur. I had that spirit. And I wasn't totally defined. And, you know, I was working at New England Mutual and then at the radio station. And suddenly I meet this girl and, you know, we fall in love and lust. And she's involved in the business. And I said, wow, this is an amazing business. This is like great. Also, the way I got in was with an amazing girl at a very high level. So, you know, the first time I ever saw any kind of money, it was like $6.5 million. She was dealing at a very high level, and I was part of that. And, you know, everything, you know, the planets were aligned. I said, this is a fantastic business.
Luis, let's go back. I mean, you went to Georgetown University. You had a little bit of an experience there. You were selling a little bit of weed, maybe a little bit of cocaine. So how did you meet this girl?
I was working at a radio station, and, you know, we did some kind of fraudulent thing with the rating books and so on and so forth. And the FCC found out about it, and I got a little concerned, and I said, the FCC is going to come after me. So I left to Ecuador. I spent 3 months in Ecuador, and I came back to Miami, and my girlfriend gives me a birthday party. I was sitting in a chair, you know, having a scotch, and in through the door comes this beautiful knockout exotic girl. I go, whoa, she is definitely not a local. She's got that flair, the looks. She came with somebody else. But we look at each other, and there's constant, you know, energy right there, constant bond. I mean, boom, we started talking. Maybe we spoke for 45 minutes, and we look at each other and say, what are we doing here? Let's leave. And she says, let's go. We hopped in her car. She left her date. I left my date. It was my birthday party. When the time came out to blow out the candles, Lewis was nowhere to be found. This guy must have been looking around looking for his girlfriend, nowhere to be found. We end up at her place on Brickell Place, and we go for, you know, a two-day tremendous, you know, party between her and me, and we had a great time. And really, it was amazing because I had never been with such a exotic, sensual woman, and it kind of changed my outlook on what all that was. She took me in a big way, and then she says, listen, you mind coming with me to San Francisco? And I go, well, you know, I got a job. I'm an insurance salesman. Says, well, can't you take 3 days off? Tell them you're going to go sell a policy somewhere in San Francisco. I go, well, I guess. So, you know, we're heading to the airport. And then I said, well, this isn't the way to the airport. Well, sure enough, we were heading to Palm Beach to the private airport, and we took a Learjet to San Francisco. I mean, I go, well, you know, wow, this is amazing. It's maybe like a young man's dream to meet an older woman that teaches him the tricks of the trade, and is just everything on a silver platter. It was, you know, the best of everything at all times, the best restaurant. We'd go to a restaurant in San Francisco, you know, spend $2,000 like nothing, $3,000, Chateau Lafite, Chateau Brion, champagne, you know, Armagnac after dinner, whatever. Crazy.
How old were you at this point?
23, let's see. No, 79. Yeah, 23, maybe going on 24, 23. I mean, amazing. Amazing experience. And she said it was emeralds. You know, that her business was emeralds.
Green stones, not white powder.
Yeah, no, because I did see some of the round football style things, and she said, no, it's because it's raw emeralds. They're not the little, these are the raw emeralds, and from these pieces they take the little. Hey, that sounds good to me. Then she finally admitted, you know, over a nice sunset scene over the Golden Gate Bridge, and she said, listen, it's cocaine. And I go, wow, that's far out. I mean, and I started thinking, you know, like when the Beatles came out, their music, you know, great music. What really impressed me about the Beatles is here are these 17, 18, 20-year-old kids making millions of dollars. That's what I was most impressed about. The music hit me secondary, but I was really primarily impressed with young kids making millions of dollars. It was unheard of. This is, and you know, that's always caught my imagination, for example. So what I told her was, you know, I've always wanted to be a rock and roll star, and I think this is better than rock and roll. So yeah, I'm in. Let's do it. So I, you know, helped her out, and I was with her for about a year, and then we broke up. And during that year, you know, I met all those great connections she had out west, which was key. That was very important because back then, Miami was a nut house, and back then 5 kilos in Miami was a big deal, but you were dealing with a lot of, you know, delinquent types, and she was dealing with some really clean cut American smugglers that were smuggling from the 70s the hash from Asia and in Lebanon also, and these were really honest, clean cut hash dealers that, while they were waiting for a trip that could take 9 months, they decided to invest some money in cocaine, and why not? And, you know, they started buying hundreds of kilos at a time. Unheard of. She was like the goose that laid the golden.
What year was this?
79, where that, you know, that stuff was going for 65,000 a kilo. You know, for Medellin, she was a golden girl for the Medellin cartel. They were having trouble in Miami over 5 kilos and 10 kilos and dealing with, you know, Cubans down here that were fighting it out with the Colombians. And here we hook up with these gringos that are just as honest as they come. They give you all the money in hundreds, beautifully stacked, nothing's missing, and it's constant. So this was an amazing thing. that I fell into.
It was less Scarface and more like dealing with Ford or dealing with Chrysler.
On a handshake. These marijuana hash people were not your crazy cocaine cowboys that were happening down in Miami. These were gentlemen, great, really cool people, nonviolent. But they just happened to be in that market for so many years that, you know, to them moving this, they were the original smugglers, the original big time, very smart, logistical minded people to plan a trip of Thai stick from Thailand. Or, you know, they used to use research vessels. They used to invest a lot of money in equipment. Very, very interesting people, the way they worked. And I was always very intrigued of their style and professionalism.
So did you start freelancing when you split up with this lady? What happened?
No. You know, she knew I was going to, she didn't want me to continue after I broke up with her because she knew how bad this business was. And she thought, well, this kid's going to end up in Miami selling 2 kilos and he's going to get killed. So she says, well, if you're in, you know, you insist on staying, you might as well stay with my people under their umbrella, under their wings. So she left me in the hands of Poli, which is a very, very serious person and very feared, to say the least. And she knew that Poli would take care of me. And I had a certain affinity with Poli. So she figured if he's going to stay in the business, might as well stay with Poli and continue working with Brian out west. That's a clean deal. I don't want him dealing 2 kilos in Miami and getting killed by some Cubans or whatever. And nobody messed with Poli. Poli was a very, very, had a very vicious reputation and was very respected even from Medellin.
But he wasn't working for the Medellin cartel, or was he?
He was an independent, but he was with Medellin. He was from Medellin, and his main partner was Jose Pepe Sarmiento, El Viejo Pepe, who was a huge player for Pablo and the Medellin cartel. And Poli is an old-time bandito. He was a badass before cocaine became popular. They call him Poli because he killed so many policemen in Colombia. You know, he was a very deadly serious person.
But it is a deadly serious business. But you never carried a gun, did you?
Never. I never was interested in guns. I didn't know about guns. And when I saw people that really carried guns and used guns, I said, you know, I'm no match for people that really know how to use a gun. Why should I use a gun? You know, so I always came across as nonviolent, no guns, and that was not part of my, you know, facade. I didn't want to be associated with that. Now, people around me were very good at using guns. So, but I figured if a gun battle broke out, I was not going to make the difference because I didn't know how to use those things. So
what about the violence attached to it? You know better than most that with all kinds of anything that's illegal, people have to protect it from other people taking them down. And they use violence, intimidation, fear to hurt people. You witnessed that? You must have witnessed it firsthand.
Yes. People make mistakes, you know. These people that give you 100 kilos, 200 kilos, 5 kilos, 3 kilos. Most of these people have a reputation of being violent. So most cases that I've seen is, you know, people go up to them and think they can take them for a ride. And it's an insult to go ask somebody that you know has a violent side, you know, and they give you something and you take it from them. You know, here in this business, you steal, you die. But it's not like they tell you, no, we're cool people, you know, we're cool, we won't kill you. No, they tell you right up front, you take our shit, you don't pay us, you're going to die.
And people have died thousands yeah. and thousands and thousands.
And people continue to think they can outsmart other people, and that's big mistakes. You know, there's nothing like the truth. I've lost merchandise, but I'm truthful about it, and I prove it. Listen, this wasn't stolen. This was lost. Boom. And I've always, you know, faced up to it. And I have to admit, at the start, you know, I started distribution in California. So I had a very good reputation. People knew I had excellent clients that paid. So I was very fortunate to create a lot of goodwill in that business. And, you know, people always was, you know, the Colombian side, they were offering me always major amounts of merchandise for me to move because they knew I had good outlets.
Was it simply you getting on a plane with blocks, kilo blocks of cocaine in Miami, flying to San Francisco or to wherever in California, going to a hotel, opening up the suitcase, handing over five blocks, then getting millions of dollars back? How it worked?
Well, we did do that. We did on and off take 12 or 15 kilos that would, you know, be left over of, you know, certain batches, because we didn't want to sell them in Miami. We always sold them securely in San Francisco. And back then, you put them in a suitcase or you put them in your handbag and you fly to San Francisco. I just hand over the bag. But most of the merchandise was being transported in trucks or cars with hidden compartments. And we'd send 100, 120 at a time.
120 kilos.
Yes, back then, which was a lot at 65. We would be doing this constantly. And after a while, I had three or four clients buying 120 kilos a month. That's a lot of merchandise back then.
That's also a heck of a lot of cash, Luis.
Well, at times I had, you know, 500 kilos out there.
What did you do with the cash? What did you do with
Well, most of it belonged to Colombia. Most of it belonged to the owners of the merchandise. I charged, you know, a difference in price, $3,000-$4,000 a kilo, which was mine. But the bulk of the money went back to Colombia. And then it got to a point that I couldn't deal with it anymore. I couldn't deal with, you know, millions and millions of dollars out west and having to bring it back to Miami. I had to buy cars to transport the money at all times. And then the Colombians set up a banking system for me out west where I used to just deliver them the money to their bankers out west and alleviate. I said, I can't do both. Either I'm selling, but this business of taking the money back to Miami, it's a full-time situation here, and I don't want to be responsible for, you know, 15 million, you know, in a car or two cars. You know, we wouldn't put more than 5 or 6 million in each car. But suddenly you have, you know, 3, 4, 5 cars heading back, and it's, you know, it's stressful.
But how stressful was it, and what did you do to release the stress?
I drank, I partied. We were a party group. I mean, I guess that's what I did to release the stress: drink and party. I mean, I never went mountain climbing, and I never, you know, released the adrenaline any other way. My business was enough adrenaline, and back then, I always wanted to keep a low profile because it's very dangerous. You know, people know that you're moving that much weight. People get weird ideas, kidnap this guy. But then again, if you kidnap me, then okay, you kidnap me, you end up kidnapping a liability because I'm a guy that now owes $10 million to the Medellin cartel, and you kidnap me, well, they're going to charge you the $10 million. So, but still, I always kept a very low profile, and I didn't ever looked that much like a criminal and just kept away from.
But in terms of the partying, did you ever get high on your own supply?
Yes. For many years, you know, I was, you know, hooked on that. I never snorted never, never snorted if I didn't have a drink. It was always, you start drinking and then you want to snort. I've never snorted without drinking. Alcohol was the initiator. You start drinking and you want, and then drinking and snorting is a good combination. You know, you can go on for days. So alcohol is a bad one. Cocaine is a bad one. They're all bad. Pot is a very mellow situation. I smoked pot early on, but then I stopped. Once I started drinking and snorting, I never smoked pot again. I don't recommend that to anybody.
You're still here, though, Lewis. You're still here.
I'm still here. It's amazing that I'm here. I don't know. Like I said, I don't know. I really don't know. I was just a very fortunate person, and the planets must have been aligned for a very long time. 25 years is a long time. It's not what I did. It's how long I did it for.
Yeah, not many people do it for that long and live. Did you lose friends?
Oh, yes. Yes. I lost friends in Colombia. I lost a very good friend here in Miami. You know, he used to work for the Italian mafia, and his own people killed him and, you know, put him in a cement drum and dumped the drum with his body in it in a canal in Hialeah. It was discovered later. And he was a very close friend of mine. It's in the book. And so I've lost friends, yes.
Was there a constant fear inside of you that it could go wrong at any minute? You could be shot in the back of the head or arrested?
You know, shot in the back of the head, no, because I felt secure with the people I was with. And believe me, I dealt with some real crazies. But somehow the other, you know, I always had a knack for these crazies, and they liked me. And there was always a bond with these ultra crazies. I don't know why. Maybe they thought I was crazier than they were. They said, this guy must be coming here to ask me for 5,000 kilos. This guy must be out of his mind. And he doesn't carry a gun, and he's got a great reputation to making it. He doesn't lose many loads. And that's why, you know, they talk to you and they take you in. But being shot in the back of the head, no. The law, you're always moving around to avoid. I always changed departments. I always changed names. I never told anybody where I lived. Yeah, I was always cautious of the law, so I took certain precautions. Even today, I don't tell people where I live, and you know, my true address does not appear on my driver's license, for example. I don't have a phone at home, you know. Even today, I can't go to sleep knowing that, you know, some idiot knows where I live.
But you've got family, haven't you?
Yes, I do.
I mean, and one of the things you say is that you sort of kept it from them, but once you started having a family, you should have got out of the business there and then.
Without a doubt. That's my biggest mistake, and that's a very big act of irresponsibility on my part. Then again, I didn't have time to think about all these things. I was so busy working, and it was my business. I had no intentions of ever getting out because I didn't ever think I would get caught. So, but looking back, I should have just quit the day I had my daughter. Done it, because that's a very dangerous thing to be in and having family. I felt secure in what I was doing.
Because of the protection that you had from the cartel?
Yes. Yes. I felt very secure. Because the level we were working at, you know, it was, you know, the system was already in place. It was like thousands of kilos. Sometimes I saw the kilos, sometimes I didn't, because I owned my own airplanes. Sometimes I liked to go to the landing strips and see the load up and make sure and talk to the pilot before he leaves or something like that. But this was just like clockwork. It was a system that was established, and it was just, you know, constantly airplanes going to Mexico, airdrops into the Bahamas. You know, later on, boats going to Jamaica, boats going to Central America. In the end, it was freighters. In the end, it was freighters. Yeah, freighters going to Europe. So, I mean, I went from distribution to then going and setting up offices in Colombia, which were export offices. And at any given time, I'd have 6 or 7 good routes that we were feeding. So at any moment, we had 6, 7, 8,000 kilos in movement.
I was in Belize at a certain point, and they were calling them, the billionaire fishermen, because at one point, one of the cartels was sending 10 big ribs, like with like 5 big outboard motors on it, with 100 keys on, and it could afford to send 10 boats with 100 keys on each, knowing that if one got through, that was enough to make them a profit.
We worked a lot in Belize, but we would always send 1,800, 1,200. We would send 1,600 on a boat to Cancun constantly. We used to airdrop off Cozumel. I worked a lot in Belize, a lot. I'm very familiar with Belize. We used to land planes in the western part, northwestern part of Belize, and then that merchandise would go to Mexico and eventually to the U.S. But worked a lot in Belize. Moved 20,000-30,000 kilos easily through Belize, if not more.
You traveled to all these countries. Did you not raise a suspicion? Were you not? Did you just not start raising a suspicion with the DEA and others?
Well, I traveled with different names, and you know, I moved in a way that, you know, I think it was secure because I never got arrested. You know, I had an incident in Mexico once coming from Cuba with my Mexican passport because the guy that usually received me wasn't there. But I always liked being hands-on to a certain point, you know, and that went a long way with the people that I worked with. Because at least they could say, you know, if there was a problem, I was there. You know, I always liked to, you know, give them that security that I was going to be there. And there were problems, and you know, they got fixed. And I participated in making sure they got fixed.
What about then, Lewis, about the people at the very bottom? I mean, I've been into Peru, for instance, where I think you made about, nearly $1 million worth of paste there, which by the time it's stamped on and it ends up in Washington, could have been worth $50 million. I don't know. But it was a lot of paste, cocaine paste, you know, a lot. But those people, they were earning $10 a week, $10.
It's very sad. It's very sad. And they're earning $10 a week, and probably they'd be earning $0 a week if they weren't involved in that. But it's very sad because that's part of the reason I said we should legalize this shit, make it fair trade. And if a kilo is sold for $50,000 somewhere, a chunk of that should go to the poor people. I mean, that's way down the line, but it's very sad, you know, the collateral damage, the abuse, the human abuse, the human addiction, the abuse to the ecosystem. And once you legalize it, you start putting checks into all this chaos that's going on. But the poor people at the bottom, there's a lot of abuse. You know it. You've been there.
But also, I mean, people often forget that FARC paid for their war through the sale of cocaine, right?
Oh, my God. One of the worst presidents of Colombia, Andrés Pastrana, gave the FARC like 42,000 square kilometers in the middle of nowhere. And it was a demilitarized zone. All they did for I don't know how many years is cook cocaine. I think there must still be some of that coke being exported. The FARC financed their whole operation with cocaine. They are they are the fourth cartel and probably one of the largest cartels today, if not the largest. A lot of the coke going into Ecuador is FARC cocaine. That's why Colombians had to go in there and nail Raul Reyes that was hanging out in Ecuador. The FARC has a tremendous amount of cocaine.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
So number two big ones. You're the first person I've ever spoken to that actually met Pablo Escobar. I know you didn't spend a lot of time with him. How did you find him?
I was, we had just airdropped in Tucson, Arizona, and some kilos hit some cactuses. And there was thorns in the kilos when they got delivered to L.A. So I was working with Pablo Correa, who was Pablo Escobar's one of main partners back then. And I was at his farm and, you know, I went to talk to him because he said, you know, I hope this doesn't happen again. And he showed me one of the kilos that had been airdropped. They had sent it back to him. And then we got thorns in the kilos. You know, this isn't good for business here. And I said, I understand, you know, we're not airdropping in that area anymore. And, you know, this won't happen again, obviously. And while I was there, Pablo came in with his entourage of people. He was there to see Pablo on some other business, but also they, you know, Pablo showed him the kilo with the thorns. And, you know, I shook his hand. He said, hi, very cordial person. He spoke, went into the office, spoke to Pablo, and then he came out and said, you know, kilos and cocaine don't mix. And, you know, have a good day, suerte. And he left with his entourage of people. I also worked with Negro Galeano, who was also a top-level associate of Pablo. So I was working with exclusively with the Medellin cartel. Later on, I worked with Northern Valley and with Cali. I was one of the few people that worked with various cartels at the same time. That was unheard of.
Lewis, yeah, why is that? Is that because you were the man that didn't carry a gun, because you were the negotiator, because you were the businessman?
I think a lot had to do with that. And I always kept a low profile. And after the Medellin cartel, you know, fell apart. I did a little work with a few people in the Cali cartel, and then I moved directly into the Northern Valley cartel that became the largest and most powerful cartel after the Medellin cartel.
You got kidnapped, didn't you? More than once. Can you tell me about that?
Well, the first time was, you know, when I was doing a pot trip, which was my first and last. You know, close to the mountains bordering Colombia with the area of Valledupar and Venezuela, around there. We just walked into the wrong territory, and the guerrillas group that was there grabbed the bean, you know, and, you know, I told him what I was doing. You know, I'm here to buy 35,000 pounds of pot. And he says, well, who gave you permission to come in here? He says, well, we're actually buying it from some people that these people know. And he says, well, now, you know, you're kidnapped. And they were asking like for $2 million. And I said, listen, why kidnap me for $2 million? Let's be partners. We can make $2 million a month. As I say, that sounds good. So I'll buy the 35,000 pounds from you. And he says, wow, that's not a bad idea. We became friends with this comandante. And when I went back to Santa Marta, these guys that I was supposed to buy them from them, they were a little pissed. I said, you know what? Take it up with El Comandante, you know? And that was the end of that. Nobody wanted to take it up with him. And, you know, that trip was lost, but I paid the guy.
That sort of sums a bit of you up, doesn't it, Lewis? You are an entrepreneur. Even when you've got a gun aimed at you, you can cut a deal, right?
Yes. Yes, that is true. And the second time I got kidnapped was over some rumor that was spread about me, you know, saying the wrong thing about the person I worked with in back in Colombia. And it got back to him, and he sent for me. But when they send for you, it's better, don't wait for them to come pick you up. It's better for you to go and show up. Because in Spanish, there's a saying that says, la cara del ángel hace el milagro. The angel's face makes the miracle. So you show up. And I showed up, and I was held for 21 days. Thing is that most cases, when there's this kind of discrepancy and you're held, what you wish for is a quick death, that they don't torture you. If they find out you did the wrong thing, that you did steal, that you did talk bad about them, that you did do something wrong, they will fuck you up. They will torture you, and depending on the gravity of what you did, of course.
There is like a sliding scale as to how much pain you will feel before you die, depending on the gravity of the offense.
Yeah. If they feel really insulted, and depends what crazy ties you up to. You know, some of these people are crazier than others. In my case, you know, there was a discrepancy about money, or they said there was, and there was rumors that I had said certain things about this person. And then they looked into all this, and they found out it was not true. At the end of 21 days, I was let go. But you're at a farm, and you know that phone could ring at any time, and it's that phone call that says, kill him. That psychologically takes a toll on you, all right? When my wife, towards the end, I didn't know all this was going on, but, you know, my wife went and spoke to them and offered them her jewels or paintings and everything, and says, we don't want anything from you. It's with Lewis. And but she went there and spoke to these people and begged for my life also. She said, please, you know, don't kill them. You know, all these rumors are not true. They called her back and they said, you're right. It's not true. So we're going to let them go. And, you know, they really like my wife. They really highly respect her. She's the real hero of this whole story. She really is.
And you managed to stay together for a long time, right?
For a while. And later on, we separated, but we are still very good friends. And in my book, she's the greatest woman that's walked this planet. And she's the real hero, like I said. And the other time I was in Mexico, and, you know, I was in Cancun, and I had a load in Belize, and I was in Cancun because I was going to hand it over to the local person running the Cancun for the Juarez cartel, for Amado Carrillo. And I got to Cancun and I couldn't find this person. So I went to a hotel that I knew that they owned, and I ran into his local transporter, the guy that used to pick up the merchandise and the big gasoline trucks and transport it to Houston. And I ran into him. I said, hey, I'm glad I ran into you because I got 800 kilos down in Belize. And I'm looking to move them up here. So I'm glad I ran into you. Oh, fantastic. Have you spoken to, Metro? I go, no, I've been looking for him. I haven't found him. So we started playing pool, drinking, boom, boom. I lost $250,000 that night playing pool.
You lost how much?
$250,000.
$250,000.
Yeah, on one game.
$250,000.
Yeah, I said, listen, let's play for 250. I got the 800 kilos in Belize. If you win, take 50 kilos. They're yours. If I win, give me a $250,000 break on the transport. So I said, you're on. Boom, we lost like nothing. And I went back to the hotel. Next morning, I wake up to play tennis, and I'm on a phone. I finish my tennis game. I'm on a pay phone, and suddenly they yanked me from behind, pulled my hair, hit me with an AK-47, tried to put me in a Tahoe, you know, a Chevy Tahoe, you know, SUV type. And it was Metro with his guys. And I was going, what the fuck? You're working here. You didn't tell me anything. You're under the radar. You're trying to sneak a trip, you know, through me. This is my territory. Nobody works here. But what do you look? I was here last night trying to look for you. I couldn't find you. I found Heel. I got drunk with Heel. We played pool. Lost $250,000. That's the craziest story. Boom. I'm feeding you to the alligators.
This is a guy called Metro.
Very volatile, violent history guy.
But he's a man that likes to watch people being fed to alligators.
I guess so. Thank God I never experienced it. It got close.
How close? How close?
I would say about 5 minutes away from that close. Because I struggled for a while because I knew if they stick me inside this car, that's it. I'm gone. Finally, you know, I flipped backwards. I didn't die. And then finally I said, okay, let's settle down. I'll go in the car. But, you know, after this, please let me ride in the front seat with you because I need to talk to you. I said, oh, my God, here we are taking you. Next thing you're going to ask me to drive the car. I go, no, I just want to sit in the front seat. I need some fresh air and I need to talk to you. So I go, okay, but we're going to the alligators. I said, listen, it is what it is, but let me talk to you. So I was talking to him, telling him, listen, I was with Heat last night. I'm not here under the radar. That merchandise is for you. I lost $250,000 with him. Let's call him. So I started dialing him, and he must have been hungover, and he wouldn't answer. I go, oh, my God. And we're on our way to this abandoned theme park, Mexican theme park that was on a lagoon, and they had those alligators back there. I go, so finally I said, you know what? You call him from your phone. Maybe he'll answer you. So he did. And he calls him and he says, aquí tengo el colocho y me lo voy a llevar donde los cocodrilos. And telling him in Spanish, I've got the colocho. Colocho means Colombian. And I'm taking him to the crocodiles. I go, what are you talking about? He must have said, he must have been hungover. I said, yeah, el colocho, the guy that says that he lost $250,000. Oh, yeah, it is true. Yeah. No, don't feed him to the alligators. He owes me $250. And Metro looks at me and goes, it's like you look at a person, there's this bond immediate. Like he looked at me and said, this motherfucker's crazier than I am. And he looked at me, I said, I can't believe that fucking story's true. I said, Metro, you know me. You know, you've heard of me. You know, I don't lie. You know, they knew that I've been in this business years and years and years and years. They know I worked in Cancun before. And when he came in, I left Cancun because, you know, I never worked on, we weren't working with his group. So at least he knew that. So when he saw me there, he thought I was working under the radar. But when I told him that, and it was true, he looked at me and I looked at him. And then from then on, there was a bond created. The same way he can walk into a restaurant, he looks at you and you look at him the wrong way, he'll put a bullet in your head. These people are like that. So from then on, I had free reign of Cancun. Sometimes there was 30, 40,000 kilos backlogged in Cancun. My trip would come in and I would go to the front of the line. Yeah, so I was scared when I got back home, back to the hotel we were staying at. My wife was 7 months pregnant. The first time I got kidnapped, my wife was 7 months pregnant with my daughter. This time she was 7 months pregnant with my son. And I looked like shit when I walked in the room. I mean, they had pulled my hair. I was all bent out of shape. She looked at me and says, man, that must have been one hell of a rough tennis game, I guess. I guess it was. And then, no, we went to dinner. And that night we went to dinner and we at the hotel. Suddenly they start sending champagne to the table and it was all compliments of Metro.
But that's a hell of a pressure, Lewis, to live under for 25 years. The fear of being caught, the fear of being fed to crocodiles, the fear of having bits of your body slowly cut off you, being skinned and hung up upside down, all the dreadful things that we know the cartels can do. I mean, how much damage do you think that's had on you psychologically?
I mean, it has to have had some, but I can't say it changed me totally. I mean, normally you go through something like that and you leave the business, you quit. To me, it was just, you know, part of a day's work. You know, some days are harder than others, but I continued working. Knowing that these people, that, yeah, you could die any minute, but I always thought, listen, I'm doing the right thing. And I never thought about the gravity of it. And I just continued working. It was my business. That's what I was involved in. And that's what I chose to do. And that's what I liked doing.
Can I just go back to the earlier days? Go back to that Miami Vice type time. So many young people now won't understand what I'm talking about. But, you know, we're talking Saturday Night Fever, aren't we? We're open neck shirts where people driving in Ferraris and Porsches. Cocaine is very pure. It's pretty uncut. What was the vibe like in Miami then? Was nightclubs? What was it like?
It's crazy. It was, you know, nightclubs, Regines, you know, the Escaramouche, the Mutiny, you know, Faces, Cats, all these great clubs. You know, I had three or four cars. I had a Jaguar, I had a Porsche, I had a Ferrari, I had a Bentley. I had an apartment in Grove Isle. I had another apartment up in Palm Beach. I had an apartment in Turnberry. It depends where I wanted to hang out and go party that weekend. That's the apartment I would stay in. And, you know, just beautiful girls. Beautiful. It was just fantastic, crazy. I mean, what a lifestyle. Money was things that just came in bundles. You know, a couple bundles here, a couple bundles there. There was no sense of, you know, the worth of money. Now, I know what money's worth. Now, you know, $50,000 is a lot of money. You know, $6 million is amazingly, and we just, you, I don't know. We went through money like crazy.
Do you have any? Here's the thing for you. Do you know how much money you spent in the time that when you were young and you were first getting into the business?
I don't know. You know, tens of millions. Definitely. Just a lot of money.
What was the largest sum of money you ever made on one deal?
$10-12 million, I would say. You know, maybe 15, but you know, anywhere around that area, around there.
What did you do with it? What did you do with it?
Well, it didn't all go to me. I had partners, but you know, it was a good chunk of money. You know, maybe if I kept 5 or 6 or 7, because I owned the airplane. Sometimes we'd airdrop in the Bahamas, come back, pick up, and go straight and drop a load into Mexico, or we'd do two trips one night. We'd hit that lighthouse, you know, 6 times in 3 days. The monies that were made in the freighter business, that was amazing, because we'd take 5,000-6,000 kilos at a shot. You know, you charge, you know, $1,500-2,000 a kilo. That's $10 million, you know.
Eventually you came to the attention of Mr. Harley. Yeah.
Yes.
You talked me through your arrest. What happened?
I was living in Milano. I was living in Milano and in Greece, and I never really wanted to come back. I never wanted to cross the Atlantic again. I wanted to stay on that side. I knew I was under indictment, and I felt safer in Europe. But then the office I was working with, the group I was working with, had a big operation in Venezuela. So we were buying two or three new ships, and they wanted me to come to Venezuela and have a meeting and explain the ships and so on and so forth that we were looking into.
Can I ask a question, sir? Sorry, was this during Chavez's time or pre-Chavez?
Yes. He had just gotten into power.
And there's always been big rumors that he was a heavy narco trafficker and was involved in it. Is that true?
Not as much as the people. He probably was, but the people that came after him definitely are involved and created one of the biggest cartels, Cartel de los Soles. Venezuela is a narco dictatorship.
Gosh, you won't get me saying that.
Chavez is a true leader of the people, and he had his ideas, and I'm not saying, you know, he was good or bad. You know, I think he was a nut, and I think it was the worst thing to happen to Venezuela. But the people that came after him, Maduro, and his cronies, they run Cartel de los Soles. I mean, they are hitting Europe, Africa, Central America every day, thousands of kilos, huge. I mean, most of the money coming into Venezuela is narco money.
Yeah, this is something that I've heard. They actually use military aircraft to transport.
Military is totally, totally involved. Military is totally involved. Totally. And the U.S. knows it, of course, because they've arrested a lot of people. And I have friends that I've worked with the military and the cocaine business. And I have other people that have infiltrated, you know, these groups, and they're all working with the military. So that's a fact.
So going back to you, you're in Europe. You're safe, but you're having to travel to Venezuela.
I wasn't too happy about it, and I traveled as a Mexican. The group in Venezuela was already infiltrated by this Joint International Task Force out of Houston. So the infiltrated guy, the guy that was infiltrated, informed law enforcement that the Greek was coming, because they knew there was a Greek, and they called me the Greek because I was working with the Greeks, with the shipping companies out of Piraeus and so on and so forth. So they're waiting for a Greek, but you know, I show up and they find out that I'm a Mexican. I go, Mexican? They were trying to figure out who the hell I was, this and that, and they couldn't figure it out. So they took the fingerprints off a glass, and pop, it pops back, it's Luis Navia. So they have to, by protocol, inform Bob Hardy, who's got my initial indictment from the Florida Keys. And Bob had already been after me for years, tried to catch me in Cancun, and I slipped out of Cancun, tried to catch me in Mexico City, tried to catch me in Panama. And all this time I slipped away. So this time he says, grab him. I says, they didn't want to. They wanted to give me a little more rope to see where all this was going. But he said, grab me. And that's when I was tipped off by the taxi driver leaving the Tamanaco that, you know, he had been pulled over the night before and questioned about me being a narco trafficking. And, you know, the order was given to arrest me. And then, you know, sure enough, when this guy tips me off, I don't go back to the hotel, and I tell my girlfriend, get out of there, we need to leave. That's when we left to the airport. Early in the morning, we took a flight to Maracaibo, and I thought we had lost them, but they were already tracking us big time. And a few days later, they mobilized, you know, our army personnel into Maracaibo. They had like 8 helicopters, and they had flown in, you know, 100 guys for this operation to capture me and Yvonne in Maracaibo. And I was at a barber shop, and they walked in and they arrested me. And then they put us on these helicopters, military helicopters, took us back to Caracas. And that's when I saw all the merchandise coming in. We had 25,000 kilos that were scheduled to be shipped to Europe. This was Guardia Nacional from Venezuela, DEA, British law enforcement, customs. It was a joint international task force, and it's called Operation Journey. And they were onto it. We had the merchandise in the Orinoco River Delta, which is like in the middle of nowhere. And we used to airdrop the merchandise there, store it, and then take it out in small, you know, go-fasts to the ships that would come into Puerto Ordaz, pick up steel or aluminum or whatever. And when they went out into the Atlantic, we would hit them with the merchandise, and then they would go into Europe. So we weren't really working with the government. It's not like we paid off Chavez or nothing.
No. I was more interested in the fact that the Venezuelan government was prepared to work with the Americans and others in order to arrest.
Yes, of course. They never told the Venezuelans who they had. The DEA, when I took, they took a picture of me, they put Novoa. They didn't put my real last name. I was under a fake passport, and they used that. Boom. They didn't use my last name. And but they were working. They were, the relationship was still there, and they were working together. Later on, that all, you know, went down the tubes. There's no DEA presence in Venezuela anymore.
How do you end up in prison then in America? How does that happen, from being arrested in Caracas?
Well, they never arrested Luis Navia. So they put me on a, they flew in a C-130, and the U.S. Marshals came and took me because I was wanted in the U.S. under the Harley indictment, under the Florida Keys indictment. They flew me into the U.S., into Fort Lauderdale, Hollywood International Airport. And that was it. After that, they took me to FDC, the federal, you know, building here in Miami. And I spent 13, 14 months there while they sentenced me. And then I went off to prison to Central Florida.
What was the sentence?
The original sentence was 11 years. They charged me with the 4,900 kilos indictment from the Florida Keys. There was an indictment out of the Florida Keys for 4,900 kilos, and they charged me with that. I forgot, 4,600 or 4,900. And that's what they charged me with, and my sentence was 11 years. There were people in the system already that were willing to testify against me, and I had very, very little chance of winning a case. You know, once you're indicted and you have a federal case, you know, 97%, and that is a true fact, you lose. And if you fight your case and you lose, you're going to get rammed with, and I was looking at life. So my attorney says, listen, they got merchandise, so they seized real merchandise. This is not a conspiracy case. There's more than 10 people in the system that are willing to testify against you. You're going to get crucified. That's when, you know, I asked my wife to go to Colombia and talk to the people I worked with down there and told them, listen, if I'm going to get hurt or my wife is going to get hurt, you know, I'm stuck. I'll do 35 years. Yeah, that's the way the cards played. But I want guarantees that my wife isn't going to get hurt and no repercussions. They told her, listen, he worked with us for many, many years, made us a lot of money. We're all in hot water. We're all dead in the water, you know. Tell him to do the best he can to get out as soon as he can. And he's not going to tell them anything that they don't already know. And my wife told me that, and I felt secure, so I debriefed. Now, the big leaders of the Colombian cartels were already on a path of cooperation with the DEA. back in 1998, they had meetings in Panama, the major cartel leaders with the DEA, to open up negotiations into some kind of system to lower their sentences, or, you know, avoid getting more indictments. So this was a big case, and millions of dollars were exchanged. It became a scandal. But, you know, the major cartel leaders already wanted to open the doors to lighten their sentence and into cooperation. They established that.
When you say millions of dollars were exchanged, what can you allude to exactly? What do you mean by that?
Well, this is the, you can look it up in Google. This is the Baruch Vega case, where he was the intermediary between the U.S. government, DEA, and the Colombian cartel leaders. And they say that I've heard figures of $114 million. This is a Colombian business. Colombians run the show. They set the pace. So in 98, when they started looking into cooperating with the DEA to lessen their sentences and to see which possibilities existed of not getting brought into the U.S., so on and so forth, this was already, this air of cooperation was already established. So now, that's why most Colombians that get arrested, paramilitary leaders, high profile cartel leaders, they end up getting 14, 15, 17 years, and they do 8 and they're back home. That's a fact. That's called your Rule 35, which is a reduction of reduction of time after sentencing.
And did you get that?
Yes, I got that for my debriefing. Most of my debriefing was historical, but it was, since I was involved for 25 years, it gave a very, very good picture of what, you know, of the history of this whole thing from the late 70s. So, and Bob Hardy, you know, Bob Hardy could have nailed me to the wall, because the key in my situation was leadership. When they give you leadership role, you gotta, you know, it adds 6, 7, 8 years to your sentence. And it turned out that on that 91 indictment, you know, I told Bob, you know, I was not the leader on that indictment. So he took away leadership role, and that's part of the reason I got 11 years and not more. Leadership is a bad thing to get. And it was true. On that 1991 indictment, my partner was the leader on that indictment, not me. And since they brought me on that indictment, you know, that's what I had to focus on. But that took a lot of thinking, a lot of sleepless nights. I was very worried. I was looking at life.
Is there a Pablo Escobar out there now that no one knows about? Are those days gone?
Not his style, but there's a lot of huge, huge players out there that nobody knows about. Huge, huge. And these people have partnered up with the Mexicans, so it makes the numbers even bigger. Because now the load's, you know, 10,000, 20,000. You have Mexican investment money in the picture now that just makes the amount of cocaine being produced astronomical. It's a business, and any business grows with capital infusion. So right now, you know, Mexicans are making billions. What do they do with those billions? They send it down to Colombia to more cocaine and more cocaine and more cocaine. So it's out of control.
The one thing that really struck me when I was in Juarez, and this was when there was at least 4 people being killed every hour while I was there. It was like a war zone. It was like being in Afghanistan. There was, on the other side of the border, on the US side, before you even went into El Paso, you had to go for an army checkpoint. When you got there, there was state troopers, state police. There was the city police, the El Paso police. There was ICE, Immigration Services. There was FBI, there was CIA, there was DEA, there was firearms, alcohol, tobacco, and explosives. So you had state, national, federal police forces. You had every kind of police force you ever want. Plus you had border force, right? Didn't stop the guns going south or the drugs going north.
No.
So what really is the point of the war on drugs if it has failed so spectacularly?
You know, what's the definition of a madman? One that continues to make the same mistake over and over again. So this is total madness to continue running this war on drug the way they're doing it. The drug business has only grown exponentially. It's huge. This war on drug has been a complete failure. But then again, you know, you've got the DEA, you've got this, and they don't know any better. They have no idea. It's just going to get bigger and bigger. It's a failed process.
What's the answer? If the war on drugs is a failure, what is the solution?
Take the word war out of it and legalize this stuff. It's gonna, as a business, monetarily and economically, it'll reach a balance, a price point. You're gonna be able to control it. You wanna keep your enemies close. You can control it. The illegal product has to be as good as the legal product. So people will be able to buy pure cocaine if they want to buy cocaine, pay a premium, tax dollars, and nobody's going to buy anything with fentanyl and that kind of stuff. So in all sense, you start controlling it and you start diminishing the chaos. Right now, it's total chaos from A to Z. So you legalize it. It's like liquor. You go to the liquor store and you buy good liquor. Do you buy liquor from anybody that makes it in his bathtub? No. And liquor is terrible. Liquor is real bad. And once you can buy it, yeah, people lose, you know, this whole thing about, you know, I think the consumption will even go down. Also, this is a medical problem. A person that's an addict should not be put in a position of criminality to be able to support his habit. Yes, it's bad, but he's an addict. He should be able to get health services to alleviate his problem. And if he does need the drug, let him get it legally and let him get some, you know, psychological support also. And you tax the hell out of it and you make billions of dollars. You improve healthcare. You improve education. You know, look at the amount of money that's made from the taxing of cigarettes and liquor. You know, something, tell me something that's worse than cigarettes. Cigarettes is probably the worst thing in the world. It's killed more people than cocaine. You know, fighting it like the way we're doing, it's putting more product on the street, more product with fentanyl. So you start controlling it and lowering this chaotic craziness we're in.
Let's be clear to people who don't know, fentanyl is a synthetic form of heroin, which is 50 times stronger than heroin.
Yep.
Potentially lethal. And if you mix it in with coke and you get the mix wrong, you're going to kill people.
Exactly. And they're doing that. So if somebody's going to consume, you know, protect your people, protect your citizens, give them health care. An addict is not a bad person. It's an unfortunate human being that's caught up in a really screwed up situation and his life is going down the drain. Help him get out of that. Don't put him in a situation of criminality where he has to go and risk his life just to get a fix. Portugal just legalized it. That's the trend. That's the civilized way to deal with things. You know, be intelligent about it. This war on drugs is like the dumbest. They, you know, listen, I know great DEA agents and they're great friends and it's not their fault, but it's just the system has proven to be faulty.
Lewis, you think it's also because the system in its way generates its own money? I mean, you know, to have all those different federal organizations all with their own leaders, with their own lieutenants, with their own soldiers on the ground, their own little fiefdoms, as it were. They want their budgets, they want their money. So in a way, it's self-fulfilling. You know, we have a war on drugs. I have a budget. I'm doing this. I'm doing that. Or I'm doing this and I'm doing that. And consequently, you know, more M4 carbines are made. More 4x4 Jeeps are made. You know, more bullets are made.
Yeah, it's a business and it's different sides of the same coin. But, you know, DEA agents don't want to legalize this. A lot of them may lose their jobs. But these jobs are not curing the problem. So they have jobs, and their job description is, you know, try to eliminate the drug problem. And they're not doing it. They haven't done it. It's not their fault. It's just the system, but it's all money. And the DEA, you know, they have their agents, they make good money, and it's just business. It's just different side of the same coin. The drug cartels are making a lot of money, and these agencies are making a lot of money. It's time to change it around a bit. And maybe some of these people stay employed, but working in a different capacity with a different mentality, with a different purpose.
Lewis, I have to talk to you. 25 years working with the cartels, number of years in prison. What's the biggest regret?
Well, obviously, being so reckless with my money and not getting out in time. Okay, I was handed a golden opportunity at a time in my life that by the time I was 27 years old, I already had $7 million. Whether it's good, bad, whatever it is, reality is at 27, I had $7 million. I should have gotten out. Bought in a Ford dealership. You know, what the hell? And I just continued and continued because I'm a romantic, you know, and it was, to me, it was just an amazing business. It was just a rush. And I loved the allure of, you know, doing something different and something, it was a rush. And you got to stop and, you know, eliminate the rush factor and click in the reality factor. You know, I thought I was never going to get caught and I was never going to die. And I was just going to create this tremendous empire. And I never needed banks because I was my own bank and I was always in legal businesses. You know, I had sugar interests. I had sugar packing operations. I had coffee business. And I was just, you know, living an illusion. I should have been less of a romantic and an adventurer and, you know, settled down. But then again, that's not me. I'm not the settling down type. I had the most beautiful, amazing woman in the world with two beautiful kids. And I had them and I took them for granted. I should have gotten out. At least if I didn't get out when I was 27, I should have gotten out when my kids were born. And that's my biggest regret. Because, you know, look what I'm doing now. Just, you know, I'm the kind of guy that I could do that and I can also do other things. I'm not limited to just criminal activities. And that's sad. And I am guilty of that. Chop was less guilty than I am. He was born very poor. He had no other alternative in life because he was very limited to his opportunities. I went to Georgetown University. But then I met a beautiful girl. And so, you know, I got into it, but I should have been smart enough or more mature to get out of it. I didn't.
Can I just say, Lewis Navia, pure narco, you are an interesting man, sir. You've got stories for the fireside more than most. And I think if you'd opened a Ford sales shop, you wouldn't have those stories, that's for sure.
Whatever, I could have opened up a franchise, but you're right. We wouldn't be here having this conversation, and this is a great conversation we've had. I've really enjoyed it.
The pleasure talking to you. Absolute pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Kempcast. If you haven't already, please subscribe, rate, and review. You can find me on Twitter at Ross Kemp and on Instagram at Ross Kemp TV. This has been a Freshwater and the Chancer Collective production. And until the next episode, goodbye.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.